Good morning. Some of you may be just joining this class for the first time today. So for the past few weeks, we've been talking a lot about the Buddha's teachings of not self, and talking about the self in these three different ways, three types of self. So without spending a lot of time going over all of that, I think it's really important to just at least mention these three, because we're going to start talking more and more about this true self, and we have to distinguish it from the other two. So briefly, the well, this can be a little review test too for you all. We were talking about the conventionally true self. Buddha talks about conventional truth. So there's a conventionally true self. It's not ultimately true, but it's a workable conventionally true self that's not a problem. In fact, it's quite beneficial to have this understanding of a conventionally true self. Anyone venture to try to define it as we've been talking about it?
It's a convenient name for a causal series of body-mind experiences.
Yeah. The conventional self is a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. It's kind of clunky way of talking about ourselves, but it covers a lot of ground in this short definition. In other words, the conventional self, it's just a convenient name, like I or Kokyo. These are convenient names for something very complex. They're one word convenient names for a causal series, meaning like a something that comes and goes, but this coming and going kind of extends through what we call time. Today's body and mind experience arises dependent on yesterday's body and mind experience, and so on. That's a causal series. We each have our unique causal series of body and mind experiences. Body and mind experience, the Buddha kind of technically called the five aggregates, the five skandhas, but let's just say body and mind experiences, that's what our conventional self is. And it's not just random body and mind experiences, it's a causal series. We each have our own conventional self. And then the false self, this is the one that's kind of problematic, the illusory self, the false self. This is the one when Buddha's talking about not self. This is the self he's saying we don't have. Remember the definition of this one? Yeah, a singular, that I am some kind of singular, permanent, independent, separate, like, entity of self. That's very different than a causal series, right? So the, we might even say, I feel as if I am the owner or possessor of this causal series of body and mind experiences. And this owner or possessor is a singular, permanent, independent, separate entity. That's the problematic one. That seems to be the source of all discontent, according to the Buddha. So it's really important to make the distinction between these two. And we might say, well, isn't that good enough to just have these two? In fact, early Buddhism, I would say, really does have just these two. It talks about the false self, and it talks about the in a way, talks about this causal series of body and mind experiences. Early Buddhism doesn't talk about this true self that the part of Nirvana Sutras gets into. The ultimately true self, because the causal series is just a conventionally true self. What is ultimately true? What is truly real? This is the kind of central issue, one of the central issues anyway, of the Mahayana, I think, is really getting to this issue of ultimate truth. So in the early teachings, by early teachings we mean the Pali canon, early teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha actually, in the 1,000 pages of the Pali canon, never says that there is no self, contrary to popular opinion. If we look in these sutras, he never makes this statement, there is no self. He makes a lot of statements. In fact, there's a lot of sutras that talk about what is not self. And generally, the formula the Buddha usually uses is that these five aggregates, these body and mind experiences, are not our true self. And also sometimes talks about, like, the owner of the aggregates is also not my true self. He says these are, if we grasp the body and mind experiences as our true self, and that true self here we can understand to mean some kind of permanent, singular, independent, separate entity. If we grasp our experience as something like that, we're gonna suffer because our experience is not like that. So there's one sutra in the Pali Canon where a student of the Buddha asks him point blank, like, "Blessed one, Buddha, is there a self or not?" And the one time Buddha has asked this in the early teachings, he just remains silent. He doesn't say yes or no. I think that's interesting. But if people were to ask, is this body and mind my true self? Then he would say, no, that's not your true self. That's not an Atman. It's Anatman. So in this Parinirvana Sutra now, the Buddha is going to start responding to these questions and getting into these issues of is there a self or not. So we're on page one of this handout. If you don't have the handout, it's fine. You can just listen along. We're about two-thirds of the way down page one, chapter three. The Buddha says, "Thus I say, there is no self, no Atman. And there is no self, an Atman. There's no person, pudgala. There's no living being, sattva. There's no life faculty, jiva. No personality, no observer, no actor or experiencer." So here he does say there is no self. I think when we see it in this list of other terms, we can understand that. I would understand this as no individual self. He's not talking about no true self that the sutra is going to promote the idea of a true self. This list is found also in, like, the Diamond Sutra, and I think a lot of other sutras too, when we're talking about not thinking that the separate individual is a real thing. There's no, so I might translate it as understanding the Buddha's meaning here as there is no individual personal self. There's no person as a separate entity. There's no actual living being. There's no life faculty as some essence of a person. There's no personality really existing. There's no observer of experiences, no actor, or experiencer of experiences. So that's all the negation side of things. And you might find statements like that in the early sutras too. The Buddha, all Buddhist traditions, I think, feel quite comfortable about negating any kind of entity. Not all Buddhist traditions feel comfortable about positing some kind of true self. But this sutra doesn't mind. The Buddha in this sutra doesn't mind. So this is, again, it's kind of the standard Buddhist teaching. There's no kind of thing like this. And then the Buddha says, "Oh, monks, know that what the Tirthikas teach." And I remember the Tirthika is like sometimes translated as the heretics. Those kind of like outside the Buddha's teaching. And so when I just looked this up before class, it was something like it's not necessarily a derogative term. It's like those who are like wanting to cross over the stream of samsara, something like that, right? The crossovers. So it's kind of a positive term, but it seems to be kind of like a word used by Buddhists about the non-Buddhist yogis and philosophers. And maybe particularly connected with Jainism. Jainism has this there's some like the realized ones in the Jain tradition are have a name similar to this. So we just understand it as sort of a interfaith debate going on here in old India. Those who, you know, outside of the Buddha Dharma. So of course that was a thing that many people outside of the Buddha's tradition in India were and still are teaching the Atman, the true self, in various ways. And some of them are very, very, like, indistinguishable from this sutra's version of true self, but some are a little different. And I think that's what this is pointing at here, this teaching. The Buddha says, know that what the Tirthikas teach as a true self is like the case of a worm that eats tracks in wood, from which by chance there appears what looks like a letter. So there's a lot of bizarre kind of parables and metaphors in this sutra, and this is one of them, that I understand it as, you know, these like woodworms, right, that make these little tracks in wood, and I think you only see the tracks when the wood splits apart, right? And then you see these patterns, right, and with sawdust on the wood, like those kind of worms. They dig through wood and make these beautiful curvy shapes and designs in the wood. And once in a while, if enough worms make tracks in wood, once in a while the tracks will form the shape of a letter or a word that will make sense to us. And then we can look at that and say, look, the worms like wrote the word self or wrote the word Buddha. Wow, amazing. Like in Pali. Yeah, all that, exactly. So and then we think, wow, they got it just right, and I even got some little glimpse of enlightenment from this word that the worm wrote. So I think it's saying that this metaphor that the Tirthikas are making these random patterns. They're a little bit confused about what the self is. But sometimes their pattern of talking is just right on. It actually it hits the mark, and they really describe the Buddha's understanding of true self just right. But they don't even know why it's right. They just happen to get it because they're talking about the self in all these slightly different ways, because they're not so clear exactly what they even mean. But once in a while they get it, and that's why in the last week's parable of the milk medicine, right, the once in a while this quack doctor who prescribed the milk medicine, which was like, is like the true self, once in a while somebody would get cured by that true self teaching. But a lot of times they didn't. So that's why the Buddha first banned milk medicine, because it's like, it just, it happens to cure some people sometimes, but it's not the most skillful medicine. But sometimes it's good. This worms eating tracks in wood parable is enclosed within the larger milk medicine parable. It's like a parable within a parable in the sutra. Can you follow that idea about tracks in wood? It's a weird one. So this is what the Tirthikas teach as self is like the case of a worm that eats tracks in wood, from which by chance there appears what looks like a letter that helps people understand. But because it's kind of a chancy situation, it's not so reliable. The Tathagata teaches not self. This is to change beings, and because the Buddha is aware of the occasion, like the appropriate situation, such not self is, as occasion arises, spoken of. And I also teach that there is a self, a true self. This is like the case of the learned doctor who knows well the medicinal and non-medicinal qualities of milk. And I just added in here, knows when to teach the true self and when to teach not self. Oh, that's the milk medicine parable. It's not like common people who try to measure the size of their own self. Common people and the ignorant, and I added in here, holding pre-Buddhist views of self, because this is actually, people did and still do teach this. They may measure the size of their own self and say it's like the size of a thumb, like a mustard seed, or the size of a dust mote. So this might seem strange to us from the Buddhist tradition, but there are teachings, even in modern times, in Indian traditions, where they say a true self is like the size of a thumb that resides in the heart center of the body. And it's like, it's, of course, it's not some physical organ that you can then dissect the body and pull the self out. I would understand it, in my limited understanding, it's kind of like part of a subtle body. It's not a physical thing, and yet even this subtle entity of self that resides in this location in the heart center has a kind of like location, and has a kind of it's kind of an entity, even though it's not a gross physical thing. Yeah. So some teachings say the self is that kind of thing, and that everything springs forth from that. Maybe even in the embryo, that's the first thing to form, is this thumb-like, I guess it would be smaller then, and that it eventually grows into a body and a mind. So there's teachings like this. And the Buddha says, when the Tathagata speaks of self, in no case is it like that size of a thumb or size of a dust mote. These are these Tirthika teachings. The Buddhist teaching never proposes there's some subtle entity like that. That's a kind of projected idea. Who could find such a thing? Buddha's very practical, like, and experiential. It's like, we don't propose wild theories based on just some idea. So that's why the Buddha says all things have no self, or are not self. Even though the Buddha has said that all phenomena are empty of self, it's not that they're truly empty of self. So there's a lot of statements like this now in the sutra. We're always going to keep including these two sides. And it seems like constant contradiction. I don't think it's really contradiction, it's just two ways of looking at things. All phenomena, we could hear it as all phenomena are empty of some entity of separate existent self or some sort of owner kind of self. But they're not empty of this true self of Buddha nature. Even though the Buddha, okay, what is this self? Buddha asks. Okay, finally. Here, the sutra says, any phenomena, really it's this term dharma here. So phenomena may be a little funny. And we say any dharma, or I might even, you know, this is, we have this sutra from the Chinese. We don't have the original Sanskrit except for some fragments. So it could be a slight translation issue. I might understand it if I were, you know, putting together the sutra. I might say, that in phenomena, which is true and real. But this translation says, actually, any phenomena that is true, in Sanskrit, satya, real, tattva, eternal, nitya, or sovereign, or autonomous, Aishvarya, which is related to this term Ishvara, like Avalokiteshvara, is like the sovereign that that observes the cries of the world. It's Avalokiteshvara. And Ishvara is also a term in India that means like God. But like it's literally like autonomous or sovereign. So the Buddha is saying, I might put it as that in phenomena or that dharma, any dharma that is true, real, eternal, sovereign or autonomous, and whose ground or basis has an unchanging nature, ashraya aviparinama in Sanskrit, is termed self or atman. So this is one of the Buddha's big defining sentences of what is this self in this sutra, the true self, the ultimately true self that the Buddha is proposing here. That which is, it's that, whatever we call self, and I think that the Tirthikas would agree with this definition. They're going to have different understandings of what the self is, but they would also agree that the Atman is something that's true, real, eternal, autonomous, and whose basis or whose ground has an unchanging nature. So, yes.
So autonomous is problematic for me. How can it not be independent and not be autonomous?
It is independent in this case. So we were talking about the false self, right?
Yeah.
Is a singular, independent, separate entity. Yeah. So yeah, that's why this gets kind of tricky, right? So it's I don't know if the Buddha exactly uses the word independent for the true self, but I think he might. And autonomous, you picked on very nicely that, yeah, it's very similar to independent. This true self, I think it's fair to say that it is independent in the sense that it's not dependent on anything. It's not a dependent arising. But also the key difference between the false self and the true self is the false self is an independent entity, an existent thing that exists by itself. And the Buddha's teaching is no thing can be independent. No thing can exist on its own. Everything that arises is dependent upon causes and conditions. So there's no entity or thing, phenomenon, really, that can be independent. But so that's kind of implying that this true self we're talking about is not a thing. It's not an entity. It's empty reality itself. And that unchanging, independent reality of our true nature is independent. Yes?
I was just thinking, maybe one way to distinguish between false self and true self when reading this sort of thing is with false self, there's multiples of them.
Yes.
Whereas with this true self, it's just all pervading.
Yes. Mm. That is one of the, that's one of the distinctions, yes. There, you could say there, yeah, the false self, there, each person has their own. That's one of the things that the Tirthikas say in ancient and modern times about the Atman. If it's something that's personal and each person has their own, that's not the Buddha's teaching about true self. That is the Buddha's teaching about the conventional self, though, remember, right? The causal series. Each person has their own unique causal series, their own karmic patterns, their own personality. And we know this is so. We intuit it and we know it. And the Buddha doesn't refute that appearing ungraspable causal series of experiences, self, that we each have one. And the false self would be like the illusion that we each have this true separate entity. That's not true. And the true self is, yes, it's later in the sutra it will say that there's only one. It's also going to be called Buddha nature. And there's only one. It's not that each person has their own true self or their own Buddha nature. If we, as soon as we were to say each person has their own, then it starts to slip outside the Buddha's teaching and it goes into these other types of teaching of true self, of the Tirthikas. So that's a key point, yeah. If there's only one of them. One is a little bit funny because then it starts to seem, if we even say there's one, it's like we start to think there's this one true entity or something. So it's, I think it's not multiple. It's not like we each have our own, but also it's not something. Just like emptiness is not a dependent phenomena. Or even space. In the sutra, the Buddha in the sutra picks up on, starts noticing space. We're talking about physical space, just empty space. Not oxygen, but like empty space, right? Outer space is, even in the Buddha's early teachings, is said to be unconditioned, which is a little bit like independent. In other words, space doesn't depend on anything. Everything that arises in space arises dependent on other things. But space itself is unchanging and independent. I mean, we could get into modern physics about, well, isn't the Big Bang the condition for space or something? But putting that aside, if we assume that space has always been the case, that kind of space, then it doesn't depend on anything, and it's permanent in the sense that it doesn't change. And it's singular, and that there aren't like multiple spaces. So space is very much like the true self, and the Buddha will say that again and again here.
Could we also say that it's unbounded?
Unbounded, yes, unbounded. Space is definitely unbounded, and the true self is unbounded, whereas the both of the other two selves, the conventional self, seems to be somewhat bounded just by the fact that we each have our own causal series. In that sense, there's a little bit of a boundary, a loose boundary between each of our causal series types of self. There are, Carolyn's causal series self and Kokyo's causal series self are actually independent in the sense that we can talk with each other now and we're affecting each other's causal series. So we're independent and yet we still say, this is Kokyo's causal series and that's Carolyn. So there's a kind of a loose boundary with the false self of like the independent, separate, independent and separate entity of Carolyn and Kokyo. That one's just kind of a strict boundary. That's where we feel really separate. But this true self is, yeah, it's what we actually share It's unbounded. Yes, yes.
Also, I remember that the word autonomous was kind of stood out for me. It's interesting. It must be there for a reason. But it seems to have a, maybe it's easier to relate to it as sovereign. It's translated as either sovereign slash autonomous. But it's interesting to kind of ask, what does that add? How is it different than, like, true is kind of abstract, real is kind of abstract,
Eternal
is kind of abstract, and sovereign seems to have this emotional charge for me of, like, okay, it's really the best, don't question it, something like that.
And also sovereign kind of implies almost like the ruler, right?
Yeah.
Like, and Ishvara maybe means something like this all-powerful. And in a sense, it's a little bit like that, it seems like, in the Buddha's teaching. Again, it's not some entity, not exactly like God or Ishvara, but getting pretty close to it in the sense that, like, almost, you know, the Buddha might not use the term like omnipotent, and yet, if we say it is the source of everything, it's almost like it has the power to manifest as anything, as all of us, and as everything. It's almost like that kind of sovereignty. And what was the word? Autonomous. I think autonomous is like really a synonym for independent, wouldn't you say? Yeah, and I think it is pointing out this thing. We hear so much in Buddha's teaching that everything is interdependent and dependent, right? So it is a kind of a sort of a red flag word in Buddhism, right? But I think when we're talking about the ultimate, that's what we're talking about. The ultimate is not a dependently arising phenomena, right? If it were, it would just be another conditioned thing. Like, and this is even in the early Buddhist teaching, right? This often quoted and famous sutra on nirvana in the Pali Canon, because there aren't so many things that talk this way, but the Buddha defines nirvana in the early teachings as the unconditioned, unmade, unconstructed. He doesn't use the word exactly independent, but it kind of implies that. It's very similar to that. If we say something's unconstructed and unmade, that means it's not dependent. And nirvana is like that. I think in the early sutra, the Buddha even says, if there were not an unconstructed, unmade, unfabricated, then freedom from the constructed, the made, the born, the fabricated would not be possible. But since there is, he even is so bold in the early sutras to say, there is an unmade, unfabricated, unborn, undying, then freedom from the fabricated, the constructed, the born, and the dying is possible. And then it's called nirvana. Yes.
Is there any element of sovereign or autonomous thinking about freedom that would be somehow related to free will, or like a moment before free will is enacted or something like that?
I would say my understanding of free will is a big topic, but in terms of these three kinds of self we're talking about, that the false illusory self is like the illusion of free will, that I as a separate being can choose what I want to choose, and that's an illusion, and we see because we try to decide something and we can't sometimes or whatever, right? So from the point of view of the false self, there's the illusory self, there's the illusion of free will, but it's false. The free will is totally false. From the point of view of the independent self, I mean the interdependent self, the the causal series of body and mind experiences self, you could say that's the conventional self, and there's conventional free will for that self. There's the sense of that causal series being able to decide things, but in fact, if we look closer, those decisions are just part of the causal series. Every decision that we seem to freely make was actually just completely conditioned. There's no entity that can decide anything. Yeah. And from the point of view of the true self, the ultimately true self, one could say that self not exactly has ultimate free will, but is the total freedom to express itself as anything whatsoever.
Would it be wrong to say, sort of like, to characterize that as sort of an enlightened free will?
Yeah, I think you could say that. Mm-hmm. That the true self has enlightened free will, and that it is completely free to to manifest in any way. It can even manifest as total suffering. Right? It's so free. Buddha nature is so free that it can manifest as like suffering sentient beings that are completely just pure, free Buddha nature. It's that free.
So it's radical, radical freedom.
Yeah.
So it's free of conditioning.
Yeah. The ultimately true self is free of conditioning. Yeah. That free will is not a conditioned free will. Whereas it goes quite nicely, I think, these three types of free will with the three types of self. The conditioned self has a kind of conditioned free will, which we actually don't really, it's a step towards the enlightened self. The conventional self is pretty good compared to the false self. It's pretty freeing already, right? And and part of what we see with this conventional interdependent causal series self is that I don't have the free will that I thought I had. Every decision I make is completely conditioned. Even some spontaneous act, we don't know what the conditions were, but we can assume that everything that manifests is due to nothing but other conditions. So there's not really that a kind of free will. But the false self is where we feel like, I really do have free will, and I'm going to decide what I want to do. And like, that's the illusion of free will and the illusion of a separate self. They're almost the same. I think it's a nice meditation to contemplate free will as almost one way of talking about self, actually. Yeah. Yes.
Maybe this is too much. I feel sometimes like we're somewhat constrained by in conceptualizing these things by our language.
Yeah.
But is it wrong to think of true self as the essence of, and that's a loaded word.
That is, yeah.
A word I have. Mm-hmm. Our body and mind experiences further defined by phenomena such as real and eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too much bleeding one into the other?
I think the essence of our body and mind experiences, sometimes we have this language, so I think you're right that it's a tricky term. Sometimes essence means some sort of true entity. But sometimes essence is used, and this is, an English word, right? So sometimes it's used as the true nature. It's used more like nature. Essence is like nature. Nature is a little safer word. But sometimes they translate Buddha nature as Buddha essence. Essence is usually, I think, referring to Sanskrit svabhava, which literally means like self-nature, or like own being. And in the Buddhist tradition, sometimes this svabhava, or essence, is totally critiqued, like Nagarjuna. His main his main project is to refute any kind of svabhava, any kind of essence, or he's sometimes also translated as inherent existence. Inherent is like sva, and bhava is like existence. So Nagarjuna's, that's a big red flag to say essence for Nagarjuna, but for other teachings, like Yogacara teachings, they use this svabhava. There's a thoroughly established svabhava. That's like another name for like a true nature of emptiness or even Buddha nature. So it's in English it can go either way, and in Sanskrit it can go either way, depending on which school of Buddhism we're talking. Yes, Helen. Yes. So we've talked about it the past few weeks, and it's so important to keep remembering how the false illusory self, to feel like I am some kind of owner of this causal series of uncontrollable body and mind experiences, this feeling that I am the owner, possessor of it, or that some part of the body and mind is my true self. That is the source of all suffering, according to the Buddha. And it's good to keep reflecting on how this is so. Because it's out of control, this body and mind experience. If we're trying to control it, get it to do what we want it to do and all this stuff, we're always going to be dissatisfied. And it's impermanent. It's going to die. If I am it, then I am going to die. And that's always in the background. And if it's separate, there'll always be something outside of itself. So it's always separated and therefore feels somewhat cut off and is threatened by everything outside of itself. So all those kinds of suffering, that false one. The causal series one is a lot less suffering if we just accept ourselves as a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. There's a lot less suffering, but one could say that's still just a conventional self, so that one is still gonna die, for example. The causal series in this lifetime is going to die, so it's for the complete freedom from all discontent, and kind of eternal freedom that the Buddha was looking for, the deathless, right? Then I think that's where then we bring in this third type of truly real self, our true nature. And that's it's all about freedom from suffering. That's what all these teachings are about. That's the one where we're not separate at all. We share the same one, so you're not separate from me. That's a lot less suffering, right? And it doesn't die, and it's not born, and it's like we talked about, it's completely free to express itself as a suffering person even. But if we're identified with this true self, then we can be free even as a suffering person. It's like, it's this total freedom and an unchanging way that doesn't depend on the circumstances of our life. It doesn't change when the circumstances change. So those are some ways we can talk about the suffering issue, which is the bottom line. We should keep this in mind. It's also the source of compassion and love for others, as the sutra is going to say, because of non-separation. So let's keep going. So it's not like the size of a thumb or a mustard seed. We got that out of the way. And it is true, real, and as Liz says, I think that's right. Those are kind of vague terms. But I think in religious language, people the old Indians especially, were really concerned with what is true and real. What is reality? I'm concerned with that. I don't want to be like, I don't want to be living in an unreal dream when reality's right behind my back, right? So this is as in the case of the great doctor who well understands the milk medicine, as we heard last week. The same is true with the Tathagata, the Buddha. For the sake of beings, he says, there is the self in all things sometimes. All you practitioners, learn and practice the Dharma thus. Before we go on, just a word on why don't we just say emptiness or suchness? Why bring, the Prajnaparamita was already talking about the ultimate truth and the ultimate reality as emptiness or suchness. Why start calling it self now? And it really is, sometimes in other sutras too, they often define this Tathagata Garbha as emptiness. That's one way of looking at it. Why start calling it the Atman? Some might say because that was the ultimate teaching of all these other schools. So it's like, let's dance with these other Indian teachings in this dynamic way instead of saying, we're not even going to talk about yourself. You do yourself thing over there. We're going to talk about emptiness. We're like, no, let's actually have a conversation about self. And let's be brave enough to use this term, this kind of loaded term in Buddhism, of self, in this new way that we can let it be self. Yeah.
My other anticipated question would also be acknowledging how object-oriented we are or I am, and then contemplating all these teachings are object-based.
Yes.
It kind of makes one that humanize kind of really designed person, but it doesn't really bring that freedom that they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Self,
yes.
Exactly.
Exactly. This is, I haven't heard this in the teachings, but I have the same thought of like, this is about me. It's not like an abstract philosophy. When we start, the Heart Sutra and these things, we can start to see, yeah, we have this vision of like this model of everything is empty. The whole universe is empty and we're looking out there at like, nothing is the way, is really graspable in the way it seems to be. But then I'm like almost like a big observer on the sidelines of emptiness. Like kind of watching it and my sense of self is still intact as I look out at the empty universe. So it makes it very personal, like it turns it around and says, this is about me. It's not just an abstract theory about that stuff out there, right? Is that kind of what you're saying? Yeah, yeah. I think that's one reason why self is a very nice word to use. When I was in Houston talking about this, somebody was feeling averse to this term self, and like, why are we using self? Because when I hear the word self, I always think of other. They get used together. Maybe especially in Buddhist talk, we talk about self and other. So as soon as you have self, you have other. And that's true with the two other kinds of self, the causal series and the false self. Those are selves where there is another self over there. But this true self, there is no other, right? This is, so it's good to clarify the true self we're talking about is not in relationship to another. It's all inclusive of everything. And again, then why call it self if it includes other? Again, I think it's because it's very intimate. It's a very intimate term compared to emptiness or suchness. Self is what is most intimate, what is most directly experiential. And it includes the subject as well as the object, so it doesn't leave any room for there to be some like witness on the sidelines looking into emptiness. It's as Dongshan says, in truth, it is you. And also, I think that another reason why myself has a little different flavor than emptiness is because it's emphasizing this a sense of kind of knowing or cognizing, a sense of awareness that's not there with emptiness, right? Emptiness is more like just the nature of things outside of knowing them. It could start to seem like that, whereas self, what we feel to be ourself, is always intimately connected with the sense of knowing or cognizing a world. We know ourselves as the knowing of things. Consciousness is closely related to the self. We often feel ourselves, even with the false self, within the five skandhas, the fifth skandha called dualistic consciousness, we often identify with that as ourself. The five skandhas are taught in terms of kind of gross to subtle. Sometimes we identify with our body as ourself, the first skandha of form. But as we start to examine more closely, we're like, I know this body is not really who I am. It's a changing stuff. But as we go deeper and deeper, we start to land on an end. Well, I feel like I'm just this consciousness, really. That really feels like who I truly am. But the Buddha says, I am not. The self is not the fifth skandha of dualistic consciousness. But because dualistic consciousness is related to this non-dual knowing, and the self is so connected with that, that I think self has some advantages. It's kind of almost like experiential advantages over emptiness or suchness. Chapter 5. On the adamantine body. And as you see, you know, all these sections I put in my own, in italics, my own kind of like summary point of each section, which the body of the Tathagata is, and the Tathagata, I think everyone knows, means the Buddha, but literally means the thus come one. The Buddha referred to himself as, instead of saying I, would like to tell you something. Buddha says, the thus come one would like to tell you something.
I like to think that as the one coming from thusness.
Yeah, the one coming from thusness.
That's a real definition.
No, I think so. No, I think that's how most people would understand. The thus come one means the one coming from thusness. Mm-hmm. And the one going to the thusness also.
In this case, could thusness and suchness?
Yeah, same.
Equivalency?
Yes, ta-ta-ta.
It seems like the important piece in that is the word come, that this is an ongoing and ever-moving and changing even that.
Yeah.
Thus come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just
thusness.
Yeah.
It's the one coming from thusness. Which is kind of like, it's dynamic, and it's like the appearance, you could even say. This, it looks like I'm a person talking to you. That's the one that's come from thusness. Because thusness can't like talk by itself, right? But the one coming from thusness, agata, and the one gone to thusness, gata, as in gate, is both are kind of in there in the word, tita agata. The body of the Tathagata is one that's not a body and yet is a body. So here's all these contradictions now. And I think it's not just, you could say it's just trying to make our minds flexible and not landing on either side, but I think each one of these sentences you could define, which is, you know, what this means. So the Tathagata is one that's not a body and yet is a body. So the Buddha's true body is the Dharma body, the Dharmakaya, and that one's not actually a physical body, right? But yet, it is manifesting as a physical body. It is the Tathagata's one that's the body is not born, and does not die. So that's the... So the body of the Tathagata here is, we're talking about Dharmakaya, and he will use this term, Dharmakaya, the reality body of the Buddha. It's not born and does not die. It's not dualistic consciousness. It's not vijnana consciousness. And it's not mind, citta. So these are terms that are like a little bit limiting compared to Buddha nature. And yet it does not depart from mind. It's a mind that is all equal. It is not an is, yet it is what is. It does not go or come, and yet it goes and comes.
Is this where they kind of got into like self, the small self, and self, the big self?
Yeah,
or mind,
I think you could hear
M,
it.
And mind with big M.
Mm-hmm. I think you could hear it like that when you.
Body with small B.
The Dharmakaya does not go or come, and yet it appears to go and come as these other bodies, like the Nirmanakaya. By the way, this sutra, in all its 1,000 pages, it mentions Dharmakaya a lot, but it never uses the terms Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya. It's kind of early-ish sutra, but I thought that's interesting. Maybe just because it's so emphasizing the ultimate side of things, but it might be before those terms were being used so much. But I think that's what we could understand. It does go and come in this appearing way. It is expressing itself as going and coming. Like we say in our monthly memorial ceremonies, right? The pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. But the power of Buddha's great vows for the benefit of all beings, it neither appears nor disappears. The power of Buddha's great vows reveals coming and going. Same teaching, right? The pure Dharmakaya truly never appears nor disappears, but the power of Buddha's great vows reveals coming and going in a embodied manifestation kind of way. It's a beautiful line about the three kayas. It cannot, let's see, it does not go or come, yet it does go and come. It cannot be broken apart. It's indestructible. At the top there, it's one that's eternal, indestructible, adamantine, which is vajra in Sanskrit. It's not sustained by various kinds of food. It's the reality body, the Dharmakaya, is a body that's not sustained by food, right? So it's going back to, it is not a host or master, and yet it is a host. So we don't know what the Sanskrit is, but it's in sutra in Chinese is using the character that Dongshan uses, like the host within the host, then became kind of important term in the Zen, Chinese Zen tradition, like the five ranks is all about like host and guest. So I think it's a nice term that, to look at the Buddha nature, or the Dharmakaya is the kind of host, the host of our experience. Everything that appears within the Dharmakaya is like guests. So here it's saying, it's not really a host, and yet it is a host. It's not one that exists, nor does it not exist. And of course, that's a key element in Buddhist tradition, is we don't want to fall into these extreme views of something truly existing, which usually means something truly existing. And the word exist in English, the eggs, ex means out, right? And ist is something like to stand, as I've heard. So exist is like to stand out from oneness or something like that. Exist means something stands out on its own. And just in English, it's like that. And I think generally Buddha Dharma is saying, there's no thing that stands out on its own like that. So this Dharmakaya doesn't stand out on its own as something. And yet, to say that it's totally non-existent in the other extreme, like it's nothing at all, is going too far the other way. So I think you could say it's a philosophical thing to say it neither exists nor doesn't exist, but I think it's nice to kind of consider in a more experiential way what these terms are pointing to. It's nothing to grasp onto, but also it's not nothing, you know. It's like it's the middle way. It's we can't really say what it is. We can't deny it and we can't posit it, really. It cannot be seen and yet can be well seen. And this sutra talks a lot, as it goes on later, about seeing Buddha nature, which is, not sure what that is in the Sanskrit, but the Zen tradition really picked up on this, you know, kensho in Japanese means seeing nature, seeing Buddha nature, and might come from this sutra. It talks about how different types of beings can see Buddha nature, like a mango in their hand. But it's not the kind of thing that you really see as a thing, right? It's not a thing to see. So maybe we have to consider what we mean by see here. It is no place, and yet it is a place. It has no abode, and yet it is an abode. It's not dark and it's not bright. It's not an aggregate. It's not one of the skandhas. It's not one of the ayatanas, these sense spheres of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. It's color, sound, smell, taste, touch. It's not one of those. It's not these dhatus, these realms of the senses and the sense consciousnesses. It's none of the consciousnesses. And yet it is the aggregates, sense spheres, and realms of consciousnesses and sense faculties and objects. In other words, it's not those things, but those things are it, we could say. Those things are not apart from it. Those things, all the elements of experience, including the causal series of body-mind experiences, is appearing within the Dharmakaya, is one way we could talk about it. Because the nature of all of the five aggregates is Buddha nature. The true nature of all experiences is the Dharmakaya. It is not the four great elements, earth, wind, fire, water, nor is it not the four great elements. The reality body, Dharmakaya, of the Tathagata is perfect in all such innumerable wonderful virtues. O Kashyapa, and I put this layman because all through the sutra the Buddha is talking to Kashyapa, but it's not Mahakashyapa, the monk who also in this sutra becomes the Buddha's kind of heir in the sutra. It's a different Kashyapa, yeah. It's just a different person.
Oh, a different person.
Yeah. I think that the word Kashyapa, according to Keizan Zenji, it means light drinker. Drinker of light.
So could that be more universal?
Well, it's just a name of a person.
Oh, okay.
It's just literally a name of a person. And Mahakashyapa is the name of a person, too.
That's different than the one Buddha before Shakyamuni.
Oh yeah, Kashyapa Buddha, right? Kasho Butsu. Yeah. I guess it was a popular name in India. There were a lot of drinkers of light in those days. Only the Tathagata knows all such aspects or modalities of being. All this is beyond what Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas can know. So there's a little Mahayana poke at the Hinayana, the pre-Mahayana self-enlightened ones and the Arhats.
That's all of Shravakas.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of this is sort of Mahayana politics, right? They kind of say we have a vaster, more awesome new kind of teaching, which is true. But to say that it is interesting that they can't know this Dharmakaya, or they don't know it. And I think it's maybe true that they're actually, if you look at the early sutras, they're not pointing at this, right? There's other kinds of realization that they are pointing to and that they're expert at, but they're not into this non-duality, Dharmakaya, Buddha nature thing in the early teachings. It's a kind of a new Mahayana twist. And so they could know it if they wanted, but they have their own projects of becoming arhats.
I keep thinking it's more like it's the people that wrote the sutras.
Yes, of course.
That just like in Christianity, where it's like a lot of the stuff was decided upon, you know, long after Jesus was alive.
Yeah.
They added all their own kind of little digs and biases.
There's digs and biases, of course, in any religious tradition, right? So, but it might be something to consider that maybe we could say, is there a teaching point here? It may be just that the early teachings have these two types of self. They have the false self and they have the causal series of body and mind experiences. And they feel like that's enough. We don't need this third type. It's enough for liberation. And I think that's true. It's enough for liberation from suffering. The first two. Arhats are completely liberated from all suffering, but they're not Buddhas, and I think that we could also hear this vast teaching of Buddha nature and true self as like emphasizing more like awesome potential of compassion and love for beings that's not so emphasized as much in the early teachings. So for this, to be able to meet all beings lifetime after lifetime and with this total benefit and compassion, we maybe need this really radical non-duality teaching to be able to go into like burning hell realms and things like this, right? It's like the bodhisattvas need to understand how the burning flames of hell are their own true nature. And you don't really, the early teachings don't really get at that so much. O Kashyapa, the body of the Tathagata is composed of all such virtues. It's not a body maintained or nourished by various foods. O Kashyapa, the virtue of the true body of the Tathagata is such. How could it suffer from illnesses, pain, and insecurity? So there's one kind of direct statement about really addressing this issue of suffering. This Dharmakaya cannot suffer from illness, pain, and insecurity. Even like existential angst. The Dharmakaya doesn't have that issue, right? So that's from chapter 5. Just to note that in chapter 7, I didn't include here, but there's a long, several pages on the Buddhist talking about not eating meat, interestingly, which in the early teachings, the Buddha for the monks says, it's okay if the animal wasn't killed for you, you can eat it. But then it's interesting to me that in this long discourse on meat eating in the Parinirvana Sutra and the Lankavatara Sutra, which are the two main Buddha nature sutras. So I think it's not, and also the Sharangama Sutra and the Brahmajala Sutra, which probably arose in China, also make a big point about not just not killing, but not eating meat. And those are also Buddha nature sutras. So I think it's not coincidence that when they're emphasizing all sentient beings share this reality of Buddha nature and this potential to be a Buddha, though that understanding kind of goes along with like, let's be really, really careful with all sentient beings. All sentient beings are like almost like Buddhas. They have this Buddha potential. So we're even more like, let's really like not harm sentient beings. They have Buddha nature. So that's a I never heard anybody make the connection, but it's interesting to me that all the Buddha nature sutras seem to emphasize this. So chapter 8 is on the four reliances. This is a great teaching, I think, here. This is the summary. Sharana is like, we say Buddham Saranam Gacchami in Sanskrit. Sharana, and I think it's slightly different Sanskrit, but it's, I think, closely related to refuge. Refuge and reliance are closely related. So here there's these four reliances. One should rely on the teaching, the Dharma, not on the person. So, we maybe feel like, I don't know, I don't really like that Dharma teacher, so I'm going to kind of reject what they're saying. Or, I'm really like, that's such a charismatic teacher, everything they say is just, must be true. That's the other side, right? So I think it's saying, don't rely on the person, don't get caught up in their personality. Hear the Dharma that's coming through the person. Rely on the Dharma, the true Dharma, not on the on some particular teacher that teaches it. It's a good point. That's the first reliance. So then we have the Dharma we're relying on. Now with the Dharma, rely on the meaning of the Dharma, not the letter of the Dharma. So don't get too caught up in the particular words and saying, but that says it this way and this says it this way. Like, yes, yes, but like, try to understand the meaning behind the words. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to our inquiring impulse. So that's another, I think, a good thing to keep in mind. Rely on non-dual knowing or non-dual awareness, jnana, not on dualistic consciousness, vijnana. And we'll get back to that in a second. And the fourth is rely on sutras of definitive meaning. Nitartha is definitive meaning, not on sutras of provisional meaning, neartha. So, and of course, this sutra is saying, this is a sutra of definitive meaning. I think it even says, you know, there's a much longer section I didn't put here, but I think it even says the sutras that teach the true self. I think it even goes that far as to say those are the sutras of definitive meaning. So, kind of radical. As opposed to the sutras that emphasize not-self. That's also valid sutras, but they're kind of provisional teachings that just help us let go of grasping conditioned phenomena as ourself, but they haven't gone so far as to say there's this unconditioned reality of true self. So, I just picked up on the part about jnana and vijnana because this knowing or awareness, non-dual knowing or awareness, jnana, is other Buddha nature sutras really make a strong connection between the Dharmakaya, Tathagata Garbha is another name for Buddha nature, and this like non-dual awareness. They almost becomes like, that's the standard understanding, like Lankavatara Sutra starts to go that direction, Sharangama Sutra in China does, and then when it gets to the Zen tradition in China, Zen tradition totally picks up on like this true self of Buddha nature is just like ordinary mind in a sense. Ordinary mind meaning like non-dual awareness, what is always the case kind of nature of mind. But this sutra, in all its thousand pages, doesn't make a big point about connecting these. It goes on and on about self and Buddha nature, but it never makes a strong case for what we're talking about here is non-dual awareness. But this section, I think, is the main way we can, in the sutra, where we can connect them. Because the Buddha says, we rely on non-dual knowing or awareness, jnana, not upon dualistic consciousness or vijnana. This knowing or awareness is the Tathagata. If any Shravaka does not well understand the virtues of the Tathagata, such a consciousness, a dualistic consciousness of a Shravaka, is not to be depended on or relied on. You know, all teachings about maybe even a kind of pure but still dualistic conditioned consciousness is not as reliable as this unconditioned, non-dual knowing. If one knows that the Tathagata is the reality body, the Dharmakaya, such true knowing, or jnana, can indeed be depended on. So I think that's the main place in this huge sutra where it links the Dharmakaya, the true self, and this knowing, this ever-present awareness. Chapter 9 is on right and wrong. So this does pull out this sentence. All sentient beings have Buddha nature. And Buddha nature, this might be the first time in the sutra the term Buddha nature is brought up. Again, we don't have the Sanskrit original, but in Chinese this is Bu Shou, which became the standard Chinese and Japanese term for Buddha nature, and constantly used in the Zen tradition. Dogen has a whole essay called Buddha Nature, based on the sutra, largely. And so it seems like it's this Dharmakshema that the translator in the like 4th century translated this Parinirvana Sutra into Chinese. Looks like he's the one who coined the term Bu Shou, which literally in Chinese and Japanese means Buddha nature. Shou is really like, maybe you could say essence, but nature is really, the nature of something we're talking about is, I think, really the best definition for this ordinary Chinese term. It's not a Buddhist term. But people say, people are assuming that the Sanskrit original is Buddha Dhatu. And Dhatu means something like element, like the Buddha element in things. A little different from nature, but so this is a kind of a translation thing happened here. And I every time it says have, I put this slash with R, Buddha nature, because that's Dogen's thing. He comments on the sutra and he says, he reads the Parinirvana Sutra as saying all sentient beings are Buddha nature. Completely are. So it's Dogen's phrase, Shujo is sentient being. We're talking about sentient beings here. Shujo, Shitsu'u means like without exception have Busho. Shujo Shitsu Busho is a phrase from this Parinirvana Sutra, and that's like Dogen, what Dogen starts with. But he kind of reinterprets it as this Shitsu'u is, instead of saying without exception have, he reads it as entirely are. And the Chinese, Japanese word u does mean either to have or to be. So it's interesting that we don't have the Sanskrit of this essential phrase of the sutra, but it is in the sutra. It's this character u. So I don't know enough of the language to be able to say if we could really read it as all sentient beings are Buddha nature. Dogen does this twist, but it might be like as Dogen often does, he kind of stretches things to make a point. But at any rate, I put in here because I think that the teaching is wonderful to say it's a little less dualistic, right? To say that all beings are Buddha nature rather than it's something that they have. But it's maybe that the sutra in this phase of the teaching is a little rougher by saying they have it. I think it's also, if we understand we have it, all sentient beings have Buddha nature as their nature. It's not some entity that they have, but they have this nature. It's almost like saying they are it.
It reminds me when I heard you don't have a life, you are a life, and I was stopped by that because
that's a good one.
That sense of mm-hmm. I am the false self. I am something mm-hmm. that has a
that's
life
right. That's
or
right.
doesn't have a life.
Yep.
You know. So if the conventional self is the awareness that I am life. Would that be so? The false self is I have a life.
Yeah, I have a life, yeah.
I am life.
Hmm. If by life we mean I am just a convenient name for this life that is causal series of body and mind experiences. Yeah, we could say that. Mm-hmm. And we could maybe say it from the ultimate point of view too. I, the big all-inclusive I, am life. In fact, I am all life.
So would that be the true self?
Yeah, that would be like the true self. So again, you could take any
without
sentence.
The I as identity.
Yeah, without the I as a separate identity. I think we could say our identity then is the entirety of life.
I am the world honored one.
I am the world honored one. Yeah. And Kazan and the transmission of light likes to play with these that statement and say we have to understand what the Buddha means by I. You're right. I is like the I in which we all are part of that I. You are the light of the world. I am the light of the world. Yes?
Well, this reminds me of only by observing the precepts can one see Buddha nature.
Yes.
It kind of, on one side of the glass, it's as if the precepts are the causes and conditions of Buddha nature. So the practice of the precepts are before, and then you can see Buddha nature. But it reminds me of Dogen saying, you know, practice and realization are not two.
Yeah. It's not like, so that's the sentence in the chapter here, only by observing the precepts of virtue, sila, can one see the Buddha nature. All sentient beings have Buddha nature, but only by observing precepts can one see it. When one sees Buddha nature, one attains unsurpassed awakening. So it's not so much that one suddenly gets Buddha nature, one always has it or is it, but by observing the precepts, which I think we could say mean like we're less acting out of separation, right? We're more like we're treating others like ourselves. The more we start acting that way, the more we start to see, oh, this is actually how it is. We're acting in accord with Buddha, with the reality of Buddha nature and our non-separation. As we act that way, we can start to see that's how it is. Whereas if we're like, I want to first let's see Buddha nature, and then we can start acting good based on that. This maybe won't work because we're saying like, just get away from me. I'm trying to see Buddha nature. Like, get out of my way. We're not going to see it. Yeah. So that's not exactly a, you could say it's not a condition for Buddha nature, but it's a maybe a condition for seeing Buddha nature. Another thing it says in that chapter is, saying that one has attained unsurpassed awakening because one has Buddha nature violates a major precept. That's actually what he says.
Calvin used to say, it's correct to say it, Buddha nature is you, but not the reverse. You are not it.
Yeah, that's a nice way, because that's what Dongshan says, right? You are not it. In truth, it is you. And I think he is talking about Buddha nature there. The dual mirror of Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And, enjoy Buddha nature this week. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I to be coming.